What's up, you guys? I'm Haley.
And I'm Andrea.
And this is Inhuman, a true crime podcast. Welcome back, everybody. Welcome to a new episode. Thank you for being patient with us for this episode, but I promise it's going to be worth it. Mm-hmm. I kind of spiraled when looking into this case.
As did I.
Yeah. So I think hopefully it's going to be a good episode. And yeah, with that, let's just get into it.
Sounds good.
If you're like us, which you probably are if you're listening to this podcast, then you've probably seen or at least heard of the new docuseries American Nightmare. It has been largely talked about over the last 2 weeks since it's released. And Andrea and I both watched it this past weekend, and we have been discussing it ever since.
Spiraling, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. And theorizing. After I watched it, I looked up the details, and there's a lot of it is covered in the documentary or in the docuseries, but there is some stuff that's not. And I just wanted to share the full story in an episode and give us a place to discuss some of the thoughts that we had. And so that's why we're sharing today the story behind Denise Huskins' kidnapping. And this is a spoiler warning. If you haven't seen the series and you want to, then stop listening, go watch, and then come back here because we are going to talk about everything
that happens. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is the full true story behind Netflix's American Nightmare docuseries, which is based on the true story of the kidnapping of Denise Huskins. Denise Huskins and Aaron Quinn met in 2014 in Vallejo, California, where they were both working as physical therapists. And they were immediately drawn together, but Aaron was hesitant to get into a relationship because he had just broken it off with his fiance, who he said had cheated on him. Denise later told ABC 2020, quote, "I could see who Aaron was and the man he was and the good in him. I knew that he'd be a great partner, but I could see that he was struggling." So they kind of held off for a little bit because, you know, he was fresh out of a relationship. Probably in like TV shows and movies, we see this happen. But like, you know, you're like, oh, like we'd be perfect together, but you're, you know, right person, wrong time kind of thing. So
yeah,
they
true. Kind
of held off, but eventually they did end up starting a relationship. In February 2015, things started to get a little bit rocky, though. Denise learned that Aaron had been messaging his ex-fiance about getting back together. So for the next several weeks, the couple kind of just went back and forth about, you know, if they wanted to stay together, if they wanted to break up, what was going to happen. And then on the night of March 22nd, 2015, they planned to meet up at Aaron's house in Mare Island in Vallejo to decide once and for all what they wanted to do.
All right.
They met up that night and they ate pizza, staying up late talking about their relationship. Denise said, quote, "We talked about how it would be difficult. We had to rebuild trust. But as long as he was willing to really give it this a full shot, then we could try again." So they decided, we're going to stay together. We're going to make this work. And when they went to bed around midnight, they were ready for a fresh start as a couple. So they, you know, knew that this was going to be, they were going to have to work through, rebuild trust. But they also kind of felt like, refreshed almost, like, okay, this is a fresh start, we're ready to restart our relationship.
I feel like maybe not necessarily in the context of him trying to, you know, rekindle things with his ex, but I feel like all relationships kind of come to that pivotal point where it's like, are we gonna continue to make this work or are we gonna part ways, you know? So I feel like that's pretty normal. Like, I commend them though for like recognizing it and how difficult it's going to be, but still choosing to move forward. Because I do think that, you know, there was a good relationship there. He just had some old feelings he needed to relinquish from his mind.
Yeah, and you know, like, spirit. Maybe he got into the initial relationship with Denise a little too soon before being able to, like, fully move past his ex. But it seemed like at this point in March 2015, they were, like, ready to get back to it.
Yeah.
So they went to sleep around midnight, and at 3 a.m., they were awoken by somebody shining a bright light into their eyes and screaming at them, "Wake up, this is a robbery."
Yikes. How terrifying.
I know, right? And Denise said at first she thought it was a dream, but the voice kept talking, like almost pulling her out of the dream. And she woke up, her eyes shot open, and she could see the white light flashing and red laser dots across the wall. And she was like, "Oh my God, this isn't a dream." The man said to them, "Wake up, this is a robbery." And then he said, "We're not here to hurt you." So he kind of was like, you know, "This is a robbery, but we're not going to hurt you." Probably
like, comply thinking, with me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He ordered Denise to tie up Aaron's feet and hands with zip ties that he laid on the bed. And then he ordered her to walk into the bedroom closet. Denise later said that while she was walking to the closet, she saw what she believed to be two sets of legs belonging to two different intruders. Now, this is something that is very widely discussed about this case, whether or not there were two people. We will kind of dive into it a little bit more later, but she did believe there were two people, and the one person talking to them did mention there being more than one person.
Yeah.
So the man then brought Aaron into the closet as well and tied Denise up. Using blacked out swim goggles, he blindfolded the two of them. So these were basically swim goggles that had like duct tape on the inside so that you couldn't see out of them.
That's so scary. Not being able to see in a moment of panic like that.
I know. And then it got worse because he placed headphones over their ears so they couldn't hear anything.
Ugh.
And then the messages started. There were pre-recorded voice messages that began playing, saying that the intruder was going to give them a sedative. The message said, "If you don't take it, we're going to give you an IV with it." They were then forced to drink what was a mix of NyQuil and diazepam. Even more scary, the messages used Aaron's name, which means it was a planned attack. At least he was an intended target. So this whole thing was very planned out. But then the intruder realized that he had messed up. As he was asking Denise and Aaron questions, he realized that Denise was Denise and not Aaron's ex-fiance, Andrea.
That was so mind-blowing for me because he did say her name. Like,
he did.
Wow.
And he asked, "Do Denise and your ex-fiance look alike?" And Aaron said, "Yeah, they both have long blonde hair." Now, Andrea, the ex-fiance, used to live at that house with Aaron before their breakup, and she had only recently fully moved out. So it makes sense why, if this intruder knew anything about the house, about Aaron, he would have believed that the blonde woman was Andrea.
Right.
Aaron recalled that when the intruder realized it was Denise and not Andrea, he let out a guttural sigh and said, quote, "We got the wrong intel."
Weird.
Yeah. But instead of deciding to leave, since the person he apparently wanted to kidnap wasn't there, the intruder kept going. He told Denise, quote, "This is what we're going to do. We're going to take you for 48 hours, and Aaron's going to have to complete some tasks." The man brought Aaron downstairs and onto the couch, and he basically put like tape to make a perimeter around the couch. He removed the zip ties around Aaron's ankle and instead tied him up with duct tape. He also asked Aaron if he was comfortable, which is like, seriously?
Which is a reoccurring thing throughout this whole case, it seems like. Yeah,
he's kind of compassionate in a way, yeah, I guess. Like,
it's so weird. I don't know.
And then Aaron said, "No, I'm cold," and asked for a blanket. And the man responded, quote, "Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize how cold it was because we're all wearing wetsuits." So two things here. One, wearing wetsuits means that, like, this was planned out because mm-hmm. that's a way to, like, prevent DNA from coming off of your body and getting anywhere.
Smart, honestly.
And then two, this again is him referencing there being more than one person there.
Mm-hmm.
The man then told Aaron that if he moved outside of the taped off perimeter, the camera that he had mounted on the opposing wall would notify him. And they had heard some drilling when they were up in the closet, and that was presumably this camera being installed. And there was a camera there when police arrived. So somebody did put a camera up.
Yeah.
Aaron was also told that if he called the police, Denise would be killed.
Mm-hmm.
He instructed Aaron to call out sick from work the next day and to text Denise's boss that there had been a family emergency and that she'd be out for a week. So that way no one would, you know, think that she's missing.
Right.
Finally, the man told Aaron that they would reach out to him via text and email with next steps. Around 4:30 a.m., the man carried Denise out of the house, forcing her into the car, into Aaron's car, and driving away with Aaron's car. Back inside the house, Aaron was able to push the goggles off of his face using the side of the couch, but it was too late. They were already gone. It didn't take much time after the man left for the effects of the sedative to hit him, and he ended up passing out around 5 a.m.
Oh, that would be so frustrating. Trying to, like, fight it off because you know, like, something terrible is happening.
Mm-hmm. And there's nothing you can do?
Nothing.
So he woke up around 7 a.m. and realized what had happened, but was also terrified. He mustered up enough energy to call out sick for work and text Denise's boss, as he was instructed to do so, but then he passed out again before he could do anything else. And this time he was out until 11:30 a.m.
Which, for anyone who doesn't know, diazepam is like Valium. It's like a, well, it's used for different things. It's number one, used usually for anxiety. So it can make you very drowsy, very sleepy, and like high doses, it can make you completely like black out. So mixed with, what was it, NyQuil?
NyQuil. Yeah. So NyQuil can make you pass out too.
Yeah. Like it does. Yeah. You're like,
yeah. Yeah.
So that's a bad cocktail.
Yeah. And they probably interact, like, mm-hmm. the ingredients in NyQuil probably don't interact well with diazepam.
No, probably not at all.
So when Aaron woke up this second time, he had emails and texts on his phone from the kidnapper. The man was demanding two payments of $8,500, and apparently there was, like, a flag at the bank that, like, a $10,000 transfer could, you know, what's the word I'm looking for?
Alert.
Like, raise a flag. Yeah, give an alert. So this person was smart in requesting two payments of $8,500.
Right.
He responded to the kidnapper, but he didn't hear back, and he started to panic. But he was too afraid of that camera monitoring him, so he didn't call 911. But he needed some sort of help, so he called his older brother, who's an FBI agent. His brother, as soon as Aaron told him all the details of what was going on, though, said, call 911.
Yeah.
So Aaron put aside his fear of what the kidnapper had said and called 911. When first responders arrived, they found this whole scene with the tape, with the goggles that Aaron had had, with the duct tape that had been binding his legs. They unplugged that camera that the kidnapper had set up, and they began searching around the home for any evidence. Pretty immediately, authorities were questioning Aaron's story. The biggest question was, why had he waited so long to call 911? It had been over 6 hours, almost 7 hours, since Denise had been taken. So they were like, why are you just calling now? He explained how he had been drugged.
Yeah.
But they were definitely suspicious of his story from the start. Eventually, authorities brought him into the police station so they could get his statement. Once there, he gave a cheek swab, a blood sample, and they also took his clothes for analysis, and Aaron ended up in, like, jail clothes, which...
I know, I saw that. I was like, what? What? Whoa.
Yeah. And they say at one point, like, at the beginning of like his questioning slash him giving his statement, because it wasn't technically an interrogation.
Yeah.
They're like, you know, you're not a suspect. You're only in those clothes because that's all we have here. But it's kind of like eerie that he was in those jail clothes. Yeah. And then eventually they do start treating him as a suspect.
Especially because he was so compliant. Like, he yeah. didn't push back. Like, he honestly thought like everything he was saying and doing was helping the case to find Denise.
To find his girlfriend. Yeah.
Yeah. Ugh, so frustrating.
It is. And at first he was just recounting the events of the night before, explaining what had happened with, you know, the blackout goggles, the recording in the headphones, the instructions to transfer money, everything. But he ended up being questioned for the next 18 hours.
Yeah, that's wild.
The main interrogator was Detective Matthew Mustard. And after getting the initial story, Mustard really began questioning Aaron, mostly about his relationship with Denise, asking if there was tension in the relationship, if Aaron had been cheating on Denise, kind of just really starting to question him. Mm-hmm. And about 45 minutes into the interview, Mustard leaned back in his chair and said to Aaron, quote, "I don't think you're being truthful, and I don't think anybody came into your house." And from that point forward, it seemed as if Aaron turned from victim to suspect.
Yeah, and then they narrowed in on that theory.
Yep. So Mustard said to Aaron, "I'm going to be honest with you. Your story's very elaborate and in some ways far-fetched in my mind. I'm here to find the truth, and I'm a puzzle maker, and I've put a lot of puzzles together. I don't think she was kidnapped from your home." And then Aaron looked at him baffled and said, "Well, what do you think happened?" And Mustard responded, "I think something bad happened in your house, and it happened between you and her. So now I get out my puzzle pieces and I say, okay, how do I make it so you look like a monster?"
Yeah, how do I make it? I hated that. And I also thought it was hysterical that he said, "I'm a puzzle maker, not a puzzle solver." I was like, you're a dumbass.
Like, you're not even using the right term.
I know. I was just like, ugh, whatever. Like, you cocky little turd, and you're sitting here.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't always talk, you know, the best, but I was just laughing because I was like, he's trying to intimidate this guy and he's not even saying
Not even using the right thing. Yeah. Yeah. And the way that he said, "How do I make it so you look like a monster?" Like, that in and of itself should be telling that.
Yeah.
He was trying to force it.
False narrative. Yeah.
So Mustard started kind of coming up with all these theories. He suggested that maybe there was an accidental overdose. He brought up some blood that was found in the house, but that blood was a tiny old blood stain on Aaron's comforter that had been there for months that Aaron wasn't able to get out, and it was still there.
Yeah, I mean, a tiny
but they saw that.
Blood. Yeah, it happens.
And they, yeah, exactly. But they saw that and they were trying to say that was evidence that something sinister happened and that Aaron was responsible.
I mean, it is fair to some extent because the story is elaborate.
It's
like, even myself, I was like just blinking a lot and just like, yeah. What? But I never felt, I don't know, just like my gut instinct with Aaron was like, he's being truthful, even though this story is outlandish and, you know, dramatic and theatrical. I believe him. I don't know.
Yeah.
I just did.
And even if you don't fully believe him, you can't come in and say, "I'm going to make it look like you're guilty."
Yeah.
Like, you have to find evidence if that's what you're going to go with.
Yeah, Colonel Mustard. I kept saying that because I was like, I'm trying to play Clue over here, old Colonel Mustard.
I know. I could not help think that either. But Mustard continued to spin a story of what he believed happened. And despite these accusations, Aaron continued to maintain his innocence. He stuck to his story, he didn't change it, and he claimed he had nothing to do with Denise's disappearance. When Aaron's parents learned what was going on, they immediately went to the police station and asked to see him, but they were told they couldn't see him because he was being questioned. Instead, they were taken to an interrogation room, and a detective started asking them questions about Aaron, like, you know, what his childhood was like, how he was as a teenager, if he got into trouble, if he used drugs, etc.
Right.
They also brought in Andrea, Aaron's ex-fiance. She told them that they broke up on bad terms, and when asked if he was still trying to get back with her, Andrea said, I think he would be open to it. Which, again, is fair, because he had been sending those messages just a couple weeks before. So, you know. Right. But they're trying to do anything they can to paint him as a monster.
And she was, like, truthful, but I feel like she laid it on a little bit. I don't know. I don't think she was, like, trying to make him look guilty of anything, but just maybe a little butthurt, a little sour after the breakup.
And she might have not known what was going on. Like, she, who knows how much exactly she was told about what was going on. So they, you know.
Very true.
Mm-hmm. She might have not known that what she was going to say was going to, like, help them to falsely
nail him to the, yeah.
Yeah. The FBI at this point came in and they gave Aaron a polygraph test, which they claimed he failed, but in reality, the results were inconclusive.
Yep.
And when I heard this, I thought, well, yeah, that, like, no surprise they're freaking inconclusive. He had been drugged. He had been at the police station for over 12 hours while his girlfriend was missing.
He was an after being abducted mess. In his presence.
Yeah.
He was, like, crying. He was exhausted. Like,
there's no way that he would, like, pass a polygraph test. No. Come on. And then literally even further, them saying that he failed it when
miserably.
It was
didn't they say miserable? They're like,
yeah,
you failed this miserably. And he was like, yeah. What?
Yeah. And that is the point where he said, I think I need a lawyer, mm-hmm. which good for him.
Yeah. He's like, this is getting nasty and I'm too tired to try to figure this out on my own.
Yeah. So at this point, Aaron's brother was able to hire an attorney named Dan Russo. And since police weren't arresting Aaron when Russo got to the station, he was able to take him home. Meanwhile, search teams were deployed in the surrounding areas, searching the house, nearby bodies of water. There were dive teams and cadaver dogs, because even though they definitely didn't believe Aaron, this was still a missing person and they still were investigating.
Right.
The next day came and Denise had been missing for over 24 hours. And media outlet, the San Francisco Chronicle, received a proof of life message. So in this recording, Denise is speaking and she's saying she's alive. And then the newspaper is the one who got this. And we'll talk about why in a little bit, why the newspaper had to be the one to receive this. Mm-hmm. But after they reported this to police, police brought Aaron back in to have him respond. And he was finally given his phone back. And that's when his legal team noticed that the police had placed his phone in airplane mode after they retained him.
What?
This was the only way the kidnappers had been able to communicate him. So them placing his phone in airplane mode was very dangerous for Denise's safety. And that's why the proof of life was sent to the newspaper or the news media outlet instead of Aaron, because the kidnapper couldn't get in touch with him.
That is sick. Did they do it intentionally? Were they trying? Because they were just so convinced that she was dead?
I don't know, but I don't know why they did it, but
it's weird.
Yeah.
I must have missed that, or they didn't say that during the docuseries. I don't know.
I can't remember if they said it during the series or during something else that I watched or read. But yeah, his phone was in airplane mode. Crazy. And when they turned it back off of airplane mode, there were tons of messages from the kidnapper and 3 missed calls from the kidnapper.
Holy shit. That is, wow.
Terrifying.
Unbelievable. I'm shocked. Appalled.
Yeah. And wow. Like at that point, the kidnapper couldn't have known that he wasn't responding because the police had his phone. So what if he would have gotten upset and just decided, oh, I'm just going to kill her because he's not responding.
Which is a possibility. I mean, it's very real possibility. They didn't know that he was like this. Well, get into it, but. Yeah. You know what he was capable of.
Yeah. But now they knew that Denise was still alive and they needed to figure out where she was and how to bring her home. After they realized she was alive, detectives brought in Denise's parents to ask them about her childhood and her character. Her mom recalls that Mustard asked if there was anything in Denise's past that could shed light on anything. And at that point, she remembered that Denise had been molested as a young child. And according to Denise's mom, quote, Detective Mustard said, and this is going to make you so mad.
Fucking furious. I'm like already boiling.
I know. Detective Mustard said, quote, women who have been sexually assaulted often pretend to have it happen again so they can relive the thrill of it.
The thrill of being sexually assaulted. This is not some kinky sex game. This was a probably rape.
It was.
A brutal rape. Any rape is brutal. And you're saying that she was thrilled and seeking it again. He should have lost his goddamn job. Over that remark.
Just for that. Yeah. Just
exactly. Over that one remark, he should have lost his fucking job.
Yeah. So sickening. Absolutely horrific that he could say that to anybody and say that to somebody who.
A victim's mother?
Their daughter is missing, currently missing. Like. Yeah.
And possibly getting sexually assaulted again?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Absolutely sick. It was obvious to Denise's parents that they were trying to dig up, quote unquote, dirt and prove that Denise and Aaron may have been faking this whole thing. Now, I want to pause here because the first episode of the series basically ends here after hearing Aaron's side of the story and what happened with him being questioned and turning into a suspect in police's eyes. I want to quickly discuss our immediate thoughts that we had after watching this episode, not knowing the rest of the story. And Andrea and I have already talked about this over text, but I just want to bring that to the podcast because I think it's really interesting how the show told the story probably as it unfolded in real time. Mm-hmm. Personally, my thought after episode one was that Aaron was not involved and was telling the truth, but I was kind of wondering if possibly Denise was involved and or staged the kidnapping.
Or Andrea. Yeah. I had that suspicion too, because I was like, okay, I'm feeling pretty confident that Aaron is telling the truth, even though this story is wild beyond measure. But I'm not, especially because they played the recording of Denise. And, you know, she said like the date and like some event. There was like a plane crash.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then like some other weird stuff. And her voice was very calm and steady, which again, she had also been drugged and was probably exhausted and scared to death. So we can't really judge anything based on that. But yeah, there was suspicions for sure with her and Andrea both.
Yeah. And I think that that's why the show did it like this, so that you could kind of be in that same mindset as the public was when
it's like
this
a
was
roller coaster out. Ride. You're like,
it really was
like the whole time up and down, up and down.
Yeah. Okay. So on March 25th, 2015, after 48 hours missing, Denise reappeared. As she recounts in the series, she had been kept in a remote location and had only interacted with one man. But that man told her he was ex-military and part of a criminal group that included three others. He told her that they meant to kidnap Aaron's ex-fiancée, Andrea, since she used to live at the house. Mm. The kidnapper simply dropped her off in an alleyway next to the street she grew up on in Huntington Beach, over 400 miles south of Vallejo. She said, quote, I heard him drive off. I slowly counted to 10. I peeled the tape off my eyes and I was by myself in this alleyway. I started walking down that alley and I looked at the corner street name and I saw Utica, which is the street I grew up on.
The emotions. Wow.
Oh, yeah. So Denise walked to her mother's house, but no one was home. She borrowed a cell phone from someone walking down the street and called her dad, but he didn't answer, so she left a voicemail, and then she started walking towards his home. He also wasn't home because they were both up in Vallejo helping with the search for her.
True.
But a neighbor saw her and let her into their apartment. In the meantime, he received that voicemail, and once he did, he called the police saying, "This is her. I know this is her. I know that this is actually her calling me."
Right.
He called the Huntington Beach Police Department and they arrived at the neighbor's house. To everyone's shock, Denise was technically physically unharmed. You know, she didn't have any broken bones, any like blood anywhere.
Bruises, yeah. Well.
Yeah. Immediately, they began questioning her about what happened. And her story was extremely similar to Aaron's. A lot of the details matched up. Denise would later reveal that the kidnapper let her go under the threat that he would kill her family if she told police two things. One, that the abduction was done by someone in the military. And two, that she had been raped. So afraid that he would act on these threats of hurting her family, she left out those details when talking to police, even denying being sexually assaulted when she was asked.
Gosh, that must have been so hard.
Yeah. Denise recalled in the series what happened to her that night after she was taken from Aaron's house. She was put in his car and driven away. Eventually, she was transferred into another car that she believed sounded like a Mustang when the engine revved. The whole time she was in the car, she did her best to pay attention to turns the car made and anything else that could help her identify where she was.
So smart.
But eventually, the sedatives were starting to set in, and she had to focus on not passing out. Once she was brought into the remote area where she was being held captive, the kidnapper told her that they had to finish getting ready, which was obviously extremely terrifying to her because she didn't know what that meant.
What does that mean? Yeah.
Denise did everything she could to stay calm. At one point, she was told by the kidnapper that they lost contact with Aaron, which we now know is because his phone was taken and put on airplane mode.
Mm-hmm.
But they said, we need to record a proof of life. And if you recall, this was sent to the Chronicle, and Denise was told to share a recent event. So she talked about a plane crash that had happened that morning. And she also shared personal information, like the fact that her first concert was a Blink 182 concert.
Girl after my own heart.
So after that, the kidnapper told Denise that, quote, his associates have another demand. He had already raped her once and videotaped it. This was, in his words, to have something against her. But now he told her the footage that we recorded was not good enough for his associates. He told Denise that it now had to look consensual, that it had to look like they were in a relationship.
How?
I know. So he did that again, recorded it again. And then she just continued to be held captive. She recalled that he did things that showed his, like, quote-unquote compassion, I guess, kind of like how we mentioned earlier with him asking if Aaron was cold or needed anything.
Yeah.
He would, like, let her go to the bathroom at regular intervals, things like that. So just very, very bizarre.
Yeah. He, like, took care of her simultaneously while
holding her captive.
Doing horrible things to her.
So then eventually he decided to release her. He drove her down to Huntington Beach because he said that there were too many people looking for her in the Vallejo area. He dropped her off, told her to wait to count to 10 before taking her blindfold off, and she did. After she was released, since her parents and boyfriend were all up in Vallejo searching for her, her family called her cousin, who was down in Huntington Beach, and this cousin had recently passed the bar exam, so they were like, can you go be with her while she's being questioned by the Huntington Beach Police Department?
Yeah.
According to Denise, Detective Mustard told this cousin, quote, we'll give immunity to whoever confesses first. So the cousin was like, and Denise were like, confess to what? Like, what do you expect us to confess to?
So sick. Like, I hate
And Mustard has denied ever saying this, but
Of course he has.
I don't know if I believe who I believe more.
Yeah. I mean, based on everything else we've learned about this man, he's he's a chauvinistic, first of all.
Yeah.
And he just narrowed in on one idea, and he just couldn't let it go.
Stuck to that. So he just
fucked up the whole case because he could have been doing other things, investing in other ideas and theories, but
nope. He's lucky that nothing worse happened to her.
Yeah.
Oh, so at this point, it became very obvious to Denise that police were starting to suspect her of faking her kidnapping. She was able to retain criminal defense attorney Doug Rapoport. And she, you know, she was a smart girl. She knew she needed this proper legal representation so they wouldn't twist her words against her. Mm-hmm. After this, she had to get back up to Vallejo, and the FBI actually offered to fly her back up on its airplane. But Rapoport said, no, don't go on the plane, which makes sense. But that meant she had to fly commercially, which was terrifying.
After
to her.
A traumatic experience like that, yeah.
Yeah, like just that fear of flying, being around a whole bunch of people you don't know after just being kidnapped and held captive for 2 days. Like,
yeah, I would be like, I can't trust anyone in this place. Like,
yeah.
No.
So scary. But she did, and she made it back up to Vallejo.
Wow, she's brave.
After Denise was let go, it didn't take long for the media to start comparing her kidnapping to the recently released movie Gone Girl. Unfortunately for Denise and Aaron, Gone Girl was released just 6 months before this happened, and it made almost $370 million in the box office, so lots of people had seen it.
Yeah, it's a great movie, but God, terrible timing.
Yeah. If you didn't know, Gone Girl is a thriller in which the main character, Nick, becomes a suspect in his wife Amy's disappearance. It turns out, and spoiler for Gone Girl, if you haven't seen it and want to watch it, it turns out that Amy was aware that Nick was having an affair, so she framed him for her murder. And now many were comparing Denise's disappearance and sudden reappearance and release to this movie. And it makes me question if the police would have been so focused on this had the movie not come out.
Yeah.
Like, I really wonder. I feel like they may have still been suspicious of Aaron.
For sure.
Because they were suspicious of Aaron, which, like, if you're comparing it directly to the movie, isn't really like what the movie ends up being.
Right.
So I feel like the police would have still probably questioned it, but the public might have not as much.
Yeah, the public dragged her, honestly.
Yeah, and this was fueled by the Vallejo police's press conference after Denise was released.
Oh, that pissed me off too.
Yeah, I was going to say, get ready to get mad again. So a spokesperson for the Vallejo police, Kenny Park, came on for the press conference and said that the abduction, quote, appeared to be an orchestrated event and not a kidnapping. He suggested that Denise and Aaron made up the whole thing. And he said, quote, Mr. Quinn and Ms. Huskins have plundered valuable resources away from our community and taken the focus away from the true victims of our community while instilling fear among our community members. So, if anything, it is Mr. Quinn and Miss Huskins that owe this community an apology.
First of all, that is wildly unprofessional for him to say that when it's all speculatory. Mm-hmm. There's not one.
They haven't proven anything.
No, they have not done an investigation to prove that either one of them.
To prove either way.
Yeah, they haven't. So, he should have lost his job, too. Honestly, mm-hmm. These people are just batting off at the mouth and they don't even have any proof to the pudding. Okay, so shut up.
So unprofessional, so frustrating. Raging. Like you said, yes. It's still an ongoing investigation. Like, for them to come on that quickly and say they made up this whole thing.
Right.
Like, really?
And in other cases, they won't even give out, like, very factual information that has been proven that may or may not help or hinder the case. But they're like, hard to get information out of in other cases.
Anyway,
and then they're just
yeah.
bringing out fake information, false information without batting an eye. It's like, what?
Literally so frustrating.
Yeah. I don't know what they were thinking. I think the influence of that movie coming out really affected this case.
Mm-hmm. I think so too. But with this, it was very clear what the police thought of what happened, and that they weren't really looking for any abductor.
Mm-hmm.
When Denise arrived in Northern California and was able to finally meet with her attorney in person, she finally felt safe enough to share all the details about what happened to her, including that she had been raped twice by the kidnapper. Again, he did this so he could have collateral against her, saying if she spoke to police, they would release the video online. She also told her lawyer that her captor told her he was part of a criminal organization, that he said each individual was in charge of a different part of the operation. So again, pointing to the fact that there was more than one person.
Right.
After Denise told Rapoport what had happened, he brought her back to the Vallejo police to have them conduct a sexual assault exam. According to Rapoport, police told him to wait until the morning, just have her sleep in the clothes and not take a shower so the evidence won't dissipate. Vallejo police have denied this account. But after taking the exam, Denise and her lawyer went in to talk to the FBI. The case with the FBI was being led by Agent David Sesma. And immediately, Sesma told Denise that it's a federal crime to lie to a federal agent. He said something along the lines of, there's a lot of inconsistencies with your story. And he asked her if there was anything he wanted to change, or she wanted to change, basically implying that she was lying and she could get in trouble for it.
What inconsistencies? The only thing was that she said she wasn't sexually assaulted when she actually was, but that is very common with a lot of sexual assault survivors.
Yeah. And then on top of that, the fact that she was threatened with that.
Let's not even including that part. Yeah. So you're an FBI agent and you don't know this? That's kind of concerning.
Yeah, just a little bit.
A little bit.
So after this, Rapoport pulled Agent Sesma aside and said, how can you believe she's lying when her stories remain the same? And Agent Sesma responded, haven't you seen the movie Gone Girl? Again, for a federal agent, for an officer of the law to say something like that.
Yeah. Like, and that's not fair, because how many movies have we seen where the FBI agent is bad?
Yeah, exactly. Like, why don't we just say that?
Yeah. Like, that's not proving any kind of point or anything in your case. That's just fucking movie. A dramatical movie.
Dramatized version of. Yeah. No. It. Yeah. Just the fact that he said that should tell you everything you need to know about how this investigation was handled.
Gosh, this whole, like, so it's like not even just the Vallejo PD, it's like the FBI too. They're all in on this conspiracy.
I don't think it's a conspiracy.
I know, but they're acting like it is. They're like, we found you out. You're the real life Gone Girl.
Yeah, that's how they acted. And when police started referring to her as the real life Gone Girl and saying she had done something similar, she was like, I can't believe this. She said, quote, you go through something like that, and every moment, every ounce of energy is about, how do I live to see another second? That is all you can think about. The last thing you're thinking about is, if I do survive, I need to make sure that I'm believable.
Yeah.
So both Aaron and Denise have said that when they were first being treated as suspects and not victims, they were like confused because they couldn't understand why that was happening.
Right.
It was only one day with police basically saying that Denise made up her kidnapping and that they weren't looking for her abductor because they believed he didn't exist before something else unexpected would happen. But before we get there, I want to talk about episode 2, because that's basically where the second episode ends. And both Andrea and I have said that at the end of episode 2, we were convinced that Denise was telling the truth. And we were so frustrated that she was being written off by the police.
Right.
And like when I saw her talking, so in the episode, it's very heartbreaking, but she talks about how she was afraid to tell Aaron what had happened to her because she was worried like what he'd think about it. And at that point, any doubt that I had disappeared completely.
Yeah. For me, it was because even when she first started telling her side of the story, I was still giving her a little bit of side eye. But I admit my wrong thinking in that, and victim blaming, shaming, whatever. But when she started to cry, that was it for me, because
you could tell.
You can tell. And you know, of course, people are good at crying. The actors, they convince us all the time that they're really sad and they cry in movies and stuff. But for me, it did not seem fake. It seemed,
yeah,
she seemed scared. She seemed ashamed. She seemed a lot of different things, but fake, not, you know, not actually crying was not it.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, so on March 26, 2015, the day after Denise reappeared, the San Francisco Chronicle received several more messages from the kidnapper. This time, the messages talked about explicit details of the kidnapping, including photo evidence of Denise being held and of the room where she had been kept. The kidnapper said he was irritated that police didn't believe that he had done this, and he claimed that Denise and Aaron were telling the truth. One email read, quote, "We cannot stand to see two good people thrown under the bus by the police and media when Ms. Victim F and Mr. Victim M should have received only support and sympathy. We are responsible for the victim's suffering, and the least we can do is come forward to prove they are not lying." So again, that weird, like, compassion kind of thing. Like,
we've, like, I don't think we've ever, in any case, heard of the bad guy, the criminal, reaching out to police, being like, "I did this. Stop thinking that it was somebody else." Normally, they're like, "Haha, yay, someone else is getting blamed."
Or if they reach out, it's because they want to get credit for it, not because they're like, "Stop blaming them."
Yeah,
I mean, I'm sure he wanted credit too, but a big part of him reaching out was like saying they're telling the truth.
Right.
Another email said, quote, "I/we may be the direct agent of harm, but it will be made crystal clear that the Vallejo Police Department and you, Mr. Park, had every opportunity to stop it." But even with this, the police and most of the public were still convinced the couple were lying. Denise and Aaron weren't reunited until almost a week after the abduction, and when they finally were, they were so relieved to be together and safe again. Denise later said that she got through her time in captivity by picturing reuniting with Aaron. She said, quote, "I kept just visualizing what that feeling must be like to finally feel safe in his arms again. When he knocked on that door and I opened it, we just embraced. We were crying and holding each other." Aaron also recalled how amazing that moment was, saying, quote, "I knew our lives had changed forever and we'd go through more struggles, but at least we had each other."
I know, you're like almost trauma bonded at that point, you know, like to go through something like that so serious and make it out on the other side. Wow.
However, despite being reunited and safe together, they spent the next several weeks being painted as suspects and being accused of wasting police's time and resources. The public, the media, and the police and FBI were convinced that Denise and Aaron had set up the entire thing. But finally, on June 5th, 2015, it would all come to an end. Almost 3 full months after Denise was abducted, held captive, and returned home, a major break in the case changed the way that everyone saw Denise's abduction. Police in Dublin, California, which is about an hour south of Vallejo, 30 miles-ish, were called to a home after a robbery took place. A suspect had broken into a house, shined a flashlight in the eyes of Lin Yen and her husband, Chung. The man said that he had their daughter, who was in her bedroom across the hall. He began to tie up Lin, and as he was doing so, Chung tackled him. They got into a physical fight while Lin grabbed her phone and locked herself in the bathroom to call 911. Ultimately, the suspect got away, and when authorities arrived at the home, Chung was bleeding because the man had hit him with a metal flashlight.
Oh my God, ouch.
Yeah, but the intruder left behind some evidence. This included a black wool glove, some zip ties. But then the daughter, who was across the hall in the bedroom, not harmed at all, came to one of the officers and said that she had found something that would prove to be instrumental in solving the case.
Mm-hmm.
She found the intruder's cell phone that he had left on a cabinet in the hallway.
A whole ass phone.
Yep. He was probably so thrown off that Chung fought back that he just like ran out of there so fast and didn't even think about it.
So I don't know if you caught this, but again, when the mother was on the phone with the dispatchers, she said, "My husband is fighting them off."
Oh, implying
that there was more than one person again.
Oh, interesting.
And I will wait till the end to share one of the theories I saw on TikTok about that, because
okay,
I'm sure you'll talk about a piece of evidence that they found that kind of goes hand in hand with. Okay.
Yes, we will. But the intruders had, or the authorities had the intruder's cell phone, and they were able to trace that phone to a woman. And when they spoke to her, she said it belonged to her son.
Her heart.
I know, right? Her son was a man named Matthew Muller. Matthew Muller was from Sacramento, California, where he grew up with his mom, who was a teacher, and his dad, who was a school administrator and a wrestling coach. He was described as a strong-willed but introverted child. He preferred to be alone, and he was often bullied in school for being overweight. After his parents divorced when he was in high school, after his dad had an affair, Muller enlisted in the Marines, telling his mother, quote, he needed discipline and wanted to get in shape. He ended up serving in the Marines and was honorably discharged, and he had earned several medals and a promotion during his time.
Wow.
When he returned home, he attended Pomona College, and during his time there, he studied abroad in Prague. While in Prague, he met a woman, and they ended up getting married in California in 2002. In 2003, they moved to Boston, where Muller started attending Harvard Law School. He got his law degree. He ended up teaching at Harvard, where he was celebrated for his dedication to his clients and his students.
Impressive. Wow. I'm like, jaw on the floor.
I know. And like, it's, you know, you feel bad for the kid and like the younger version of him.
I feel bad for the, I mean, yeah, it sucks he got bullied, but I mean, I feel like everyone gets bullied a little bit. So
you're probably right. Unfortunately,
I don't think it really led to him being the person he is today. I think that was I don't know.
I think that was just him, honestly.
Yeah, I think he was just born that way or something. I don't know.
But he seemed like a great person to everybody. You know, he was always helpful, caring, everything.
I mean, he was a great person, aside from the shitty person that he was. Because, I mean, he was, like, super kind and, like, seemingly compassionate and wanting to, like, help them, but also victimize them. I don't know. So weird.
Yeah, and according to Muller, in 2008, he revealed to his parents that he had bipolar disorder. Okay. He said he had tried medication, but always ended up stopping the medication because of the side effects.
Hmm. So maybe he was on a, like a manic, like in a definitely manic could episode have been. Or something.
In 2009, he said he started hearing voices, but he didn't tell anyone what he was experiencing because he didn't want to mess up his bar application.
Oh.
He spiraled into more paranoia over the next several years, though, and eventually in 2012, his wife filed for divorce, citing irreconcilable differences. Nope. Irreconcilable. I cannot say that word. Citing irreconcilable differences.
Yes. It's that sneaky little L in there.
Yeah. After this, he kind of kept spiraling, and his mother attempted to help him by doing things like giving him money to rent an apartment in Sacramento, but he was really withdrawing from everything. Ended up being disbarred, he had bills piling up, and in March 2014, he was evicted, and a month later, he filed for bankruptcy.
Wow, that's really sad, because it sounds like maybe it wasn't even, you know, a case of nature versus nurture. It was just mentally unwell. Like, his mental health declined rapidly, and it, I mean, not that that excuses him, you know,
yeah,
kidnapping and raping women, but.
And I also want to say a lot of this hasn't come from professionals. A lot mm-hmm. of it has come from what he has said. So it might be true. Okay. It might not be true. But okay. But his mother has also said things about like him kind of spiraling a little bit, although yeah. I don't think she was aware of the extent of the mental health issues if what he yeah. said is true. So that was the place that he says he was in before all of this. And when investigators showed up with Mueller's cell phone at his mother's house, she told them that he was at the family's cabin in Lake Tahoe, which I just love that she was like, oh yeah, he's in the cabin in Lake Tahoe. Like,
go get him.
Yeah.
Like completely unaware of like what was about to happen.
Mm-hmm. Officers from the Dublin Police Department headed to South Lake Tahoe to arrest Mueller for the recent break-in and attempted robbery. And Misty Caruso decided to join in. And she, in my opinion, is the star, the most badass officer and woman. And she is, in my opinion, the only reason why Denise and Aaron saw justice.
Literally, she is the only reason. She is the epitome of great police work. She mm-hmm. went above and beyond what I feel like was even expected of her.
I think so, too.
To crack these cases and other ones, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, she was amazing.
Yeah.
But at the time, she was a new detective. It was like her first day as an yeah. actual detective.
Which is like kind of, I feel like, the norm. I feel like when you're fresh on the job, like you're excited and, you know, the novelty hasn't worn off and you're not jaded by the system and all that bullshit. Yeah. So I feel like, I hate that they, you know, a lot of them succumb to that, but, you know.
Yeah,
good timing. She's, good timing in this
case. Freaking badass.
Yeah.
So officers, including Misty, arrived at the cabin in Lake Tahoe and raided the home. They arrested Matthew Mueller, who, according to Misty, looked unremarkable when he was brought out. And there's a photo of him, like, right after he was brought out that I'll post. Because it really is, like, he just kind of looks like a normal guy.
Yeah, he looks like yeah. everyone's dad. Like, not everyone.
But then but also, like, when you know what he's done, he also kind of looks creepy.
Yeah, he does look a little... He's got dead eyes.
He does. He definitely
got, like,
does.
Dead ass eyes. Like, he's a normal-looking guy. Like, he's not bad-looking or good-looking. He's just, like, average. And then he's got these dead-ass eyes. And you're like, oh, mm-hmm. there it is. There it is.
Yep. So they ended up searching the cabin, and inside they found several laptops and cell phones. They found stun guns, ski masks, toy squirt guns that had been painted to look real, mm-hmm. and swim goggles that had duct tape on the inside so that they were blacked out. Also, in the bathroom, they found a bottle of NyQuil and a syringe. They also, in front of the cabin, found a stolen white Mustang. And in the back was something very creepy. There was a blow-up doll in the trunk. It was like in a duffel bag in the trunk, dressed in all black, literally looked like there was a dead body.
Yeah.
One officer said it was made to look like someone could mistake it for a human being. And many believe, and this is probably the theory that you were yep. talking about,
that
the second legs that Denise saw in the house was this dummy.
Yeah, because he's catching people off guard in the middle of the night. He could have easily set up.
Mm-hmm.
It was a blow-up doll, technically.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a dressed-up blow-up doll, creepy-ass face, you know, like the open mouth and all that shit. And, yeah, he could have just, boop, set it up right there beside him. And when you're half asleep and blinding light in your face.
And goggles being yeah. placed on you. Yeah, like, I definitely think that could be a possibility. And... even like moving, if he like That's moved it a little bit, it could look like that, like it was moving. Walking. And the yeah. legs of the doll really do look real.
Yeah.
Like the face doesn't, obviously, because it's a blow up, but like yeah. the legs really do look real.
Yeah. It could definitely easily be mistaken. I mean, people mistake blow up dolls for people in cars. Like people just put random, like for like the HOV lanes or express
yeah.
lanes, they'll put blow up dolls in the.
Yeah, it happens. So,
yeah.
Yeah. They also found in the vehicle's GPS system several addresses There was one in Huntington Beach near where Denise was released. But at the time, detectives in Dublin didn't even have Denise's abduction on the radar because at this point, her abduction has basically been written off as a hoax. So it's not really like sitting there as an unsolved case.
You know what was wild to me, though, is like how popular her case was, even though it was squashed as being a hoax and, you know, they were investigating her as a guilty party. I couldn't believe that the police had not heard of what happened. I mean, I guess it's only 30, 40 miles away. I was like, how did they not hear about that? But I don't know. I guess that maybe it was just so soon after, like maybe it just hadn't caught up.
Yeah. And I think because it was kind of written off and they weren't even like, I feel like with the Sherry Papini case, after that happened, they were really investigating her for being involved and like for what she did. But I feel like with Denise, when they thought it was a hoax, they didn't really like pursue investigating her and Aaron to like prove that they did this.
Right.
Said like, oh, they did this. They should apologize. That's it.
But stayed more localized.
Yeah. But Misty was suspicious. She was suspicious about the multiple addresses in the GPS system. And noticed on one of those pairs of goggles attached to the duct tape was a blonde hair. And this stood out to her because none of the victims in the Dublin break-in were blonde.
Right. So
she was like, he has definitely done this before. And she was determined to find this blonde victim. Misty started researching Mueller to see if she could connect him to any other unsolved crimes. She found that he had actually been named a person of interest in several other break-ins in nearby cities. So her gut feeling was right. He had likely done this before.
Mm-hmm.
Misty was stuck on that blonde hair she found on the goggles. She was sure that Mueller had other victims, and she wanted to find who they were. She went back when she couldn't find anything else. She went back to the stolen car that they found at the cabin. She found it had been stolen from Vallejo, and she contacted the registered owner. And when she told this man that it had been involved in a home invasion, the man ended up saying, hey, have you heard of the Mare Island Creeper? So in 2015, several women in Mare Island, which is basically right off of Vallejo, connected by a small bridge, they were being stalked by a man who would peep in their windows. It was like a peeping Tom.
And that's where Aaron lived, right?
Mare Island. Yes, Aaron also lived on Mare Island.
Okay.
But the police weren't really doing much about it. So the residents, the victims, started to try to take this into their own hands and look for his identity. They followed him to his home and learned that he was ex-military and a lawyer.
What?
And Misty learned about this and something clicked. And she was like, wait, my suspect is ex-military and a lawyer. So she realized that the Mare Island Creeper was Matthew Mueller.
That is insane. So the town people had to conduct their own investigation. Mm-hmm. And they found that out. How in the hell did they find that out? That is insane.
I don't know. All I could find was basically that they went to his house and were able to figure it out. Maybe they went to his house, got his name, and then like, if you probably looked him up before all of this, all that would come up would be his military record and his teaching at Harvard.
Wow.
The man who owned the car when talking to Misty also said, hey, in March 2015, the Mare Island Creeper cases stopped. But that was around the same time as the Gone Girl case. And Misty was like, the Gone Girl case? She had no clue. So she Googled Vallejo kidnapping Gone Girl case. Mm-hmm. And she noticed something. The victim in that case, Denise Huskins, had blonde hair. Immediately thought, was that who the hair on the goggles belonged to? Misty Caruso reached out to the Vallejo PD. And when they finally responded, they directed her to FBI agent David Sesma. She told Sesma about Matthew Mueller. She told him about his arrest for the break-in in Dublin, what they found at his cabin. And the initial response from Sesma was basically, send me all the information, we'll look into it.
Mm.
But she was pretty persistent, and the Dublin police ended up setting up a meeting with the FBI to, like, show them the evidence that they had, that they had taken from the Lake Tahoe cabin. And when they showed them the painted toy gun and the goggles with the blonde hair, that's when it hit the FBI agents that they have, may have been wrong about Denise's kidnapping.
I hope
she may have been telling the truth.
So tiny. I hope they felt so small and reduced to dust.
Nothing. Yeah. Mueller was finally identified as a potential suspect in Denise's kidnapping. And this was further proven when they were able to corroborate details of Aaron and Denise's story with the evidence collected after Mueller's arrest, including Aaron's computer found at his cabin in Tahoe. Wow. So not only did they have, you know, the story lined up and whatever, they had actual evidence to connect them. Finally, Denise's kidnapper had been identified. Matthew Mueller was charged in Sacramento, California, with kidnapping for ransom. It was in federal court, so he couldn't be charged for the sexual assault, robbery, or burglary against Aaron because they didn't have jurisdiction over those crimes. He ended up pleading guilty to the federal kidnapping for ransom charge for the abduction of Denise Huskins. And for that, he was sentenced to 40 years in prison.
Damn.
After his conviction, Mueller was charged at the state level with kidnapping for ransom, two counts of forcible rape for the assault of Denise, and for robbery, burglary, and false imprisonment of Aaron. He pleaded not guilty on those charges, so his case went to court. And in court, Denise Huskins testified right in front of him. She talked directly to him, saying, quote, "Matthew Mueller, now we meet face to face, eye to eye. I am Denise Huskins, the woman behind the blindfold. Can you imagine the strength that that takes?
No, I mean, yeah, no, I can't. I can't imagine having, I mean, I would like to think that I would have the courage to face my assailant or whatever, but I don't know.
But you never know.
It's so difficult, especially being sexually assaulted, not knowing whether or not you're going to be murdered. Like,
yeah,
I mean, thankful that you're alive and just, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, so brave, so heroic, so admirable.
Truly. Truly. And going even further, she recounted on the stand what he did to her, saying, quote, "You flopped me around the bed like a rag doll. The only way I got through it was to picture that it was Aaron and that I was with, and that will haunt me for the rest of my life."
Mm, that's rough.
Mueller fired his public defender, so he represented himself.
Okay.
He claimed that he felt remorse, saying he was, quote, "sick with shame over the pain and horror he inflicted."
I don't know. Like, I'm almost inclined to believe him because based on, like, other victims' testimony, like, it seemed like he kind of struggled, like, with good and evil.
Yeah, he might have.
Because, I mean, there was even one victim he ended up letting go and told her to get a dog. Like, protect yourself, get a dog. So I do see maybe there was some internal struggle. But, I mean, at the end of the day, he chose to commit these horrific acts. So he deserved to be punished. And I hope he does feel guilty and does have remorse. Because at least there's some humanity there. But
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. And he also, when he was representing himself and in court, he claimed that he has bipolar disorder. So it could be, if he did suffer with that, that could explain some of that. But again, he still did this. So.
Right.
Ultimately, Mueller was convicted at the state level. And on March 18th, 2022, he was sentenced to 31 years in a state prison to be served concurrently with his federal sentence. He has never been charged with the attempted rapes in Palo Alto or for the Peeping Tom incidents on Mare Island.
That's crazy.
After Mueller's arrest, Aaron and Denise's defense attorneys held a press conference in which they called for, quote, "full apologies from the Vallejo PD."
Good luck.
But that never came.
Yeah.
The Vallejo PD never came out and publicly apologized for calling the whole thing a hoax. There was reportedly a private letter from the police chief written to them, but they never came out publicly or apologized publicly.
Yeah, because then that makes them look bad. And mm-hmm. they don't want to look bad in front of their community. But honestly, if I was in their community, I would rather see them come forward, admit that they made a mistake. At the end of the day, they're only human. Mm-hmm. They're police officers. They're not perfect.
Than to just avoid it and pretend it didn't exist.
Which basically just further proves to me that they did not value Denise's life. And they didn't really seem to give a fuck what happened to her. So it's not surprising that they didn't come out and apologize publicly.
In 2016, Aaron and Denise filed a civil suit against the city of Vallejo and the Vallejo PD for defamation. They ended up settling out of court for $2.5 million with no party admitting wrongdoing. Mm. There was also a suit filed against the city of Vallejo in December 2020 when former Vallejo police captain John Whitney claimed that, quote, he was wrongfully terminated for speaking out on a variety of issues that he characterized as misconduct, including ones related to Denise Huskins and Aaron Quinn's case. So Whitney claims that the former Vallejo police chief, Badu, directed him to delete text messages on his phone so that they could not be downloaded during the litigation related to the investigation into Denise's kidnapping.
What?
Yeah.
Okay.
According to ABC News, quote, Whitney further alleges in the lawsuit that he was in the room and that he heard Badu instruct Park, the one who did the press conference, saying, like, that Denise and Aaron had, this was all a hoax. Yeah. So he said that he heard Badu instruct Park to, quote, burn that bitch prior to that press conference.
So why?
I know.
It's like, did you have a personal vendetta against her?
Apparently.
I mean, geez.
In a previous deposition related to Denise and Aaron's civil litigation, but prior to Whitney's December 2020 lawsuit, Badu was asked if he recalled anyone using that phrase with respect to Denise, and he replied that he had never heard anybody say that.
I mean, yeah, of course he's going to say that. He's not going to admit to saying, burn that bitch. Like, she's a witch at the Salem trials or something.
Right.
God. It's just an awful thing to even, like, as a, you said he was a police captain?
Mm-hmm.
To even use that terminology, I mean, she was at the most, if she was guilty of what they claimed her, she was a liar.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't a murderer. She wasn't a child rapist. Like, why would you say that? That's like so absolutely horrible.
Yeah, absolutely terrible. In September 2023, it was reported that Whitney agreed to a settlement for $900,000 plus cost and attorney fees. And after the settlement, Whitney told the Times, quote, I feel vindicated by the settlement agreement because of the amount. You don't settle for nearly $1 million if you did everything correct.
True.
While the officers involved in Denise and Aaron's case never made a public apology, in 2021, the new Vallejo police chief, Shawnee Williams, released a statement about what happened. This came after their story aired on ABC 2020, and Aaron wrote an op-ed for Open Vallejo talking about what the police did to them. Then Chief Williams said that what happened to them was horrific and evil, saying, quote, I am committed to making sure survivors are given compassionate service with dignity and respect. Although I was not chief in 2015 when this incident occurred, I would like to extend my deepest apology to Ms. Huskins and Mr. Quinn for how they were treated during this ordeal. Chief Shawnee Williams, though, resigned in 2022. Since the release of the Netflix series, the social media pages for the Vallejo Police Department have been inundated with negative comments, mostly directed toward Detective Matt Mustard. In 2015, the year this all happened, Mustard was named Officer of the Year. That has been the subject of several of the comments on the social media pages.
Yeah, I mean, Maybe he cracked open a bunch of other cases. I don't know, but that just seems like a huge slap in the face to Denise and Aaron and pretty much all of their victims. Because honestly, if they would have done just, I mean, obviously the cell phone was the kicker, you know, that was the thing that really got the case blown wide open. But I feel like even if they would have just dug around a little bit, maybe, I don't know, when Denise said a Mustang, they could have, I mean, I'm assuming the man reported his Mustang missing. If they would have just, you know, maybe just looked into that, they could have started putting some puzzle pieces together.
Yeah. They could have figured this out.
Yeah. Dumb.
Yelp even had to disable the department's page due to unusual activity.
Well, they had some unusual activity going on in their police department during all this. So
there is a change.org petition to demand the dismissal of Matt Mustard from the Vallejo PD.
I mean, you already know just how I put that out there. I already said it. So
the Vallejo Police Department has not spoken out since the release of the docuseries.
Of course they haven't, because they won't admit to any responsibility, guilt, anything like that.
No. Also troublesome was a fact that Denise and Aaron learned after Mueller was arrested. The lead FBI agent on the case, David Sesma, used to date Andrea, Aaron's ex-fiance.
Yeah.
Now, this may not mean anything in, like, relation to his involvement, Andrea's involvement, or anything.
Yeah.
But at the very least, it's a conflict of interest.
He should have been pulled from the case. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, at the very least, you need to say, hey, I have a connection. I shouldn't be on this case.
Which is his responsibility as an FBI agent. I'm pretty sure it's in the oath somewhere.
Probably.
Ridiculousness.
And this, like, that was, you know, just that fact should have, but it's even more so because of the fact that both Aaron and Denise, from what Mueller said to them, said that Andrea was the intended target.
Mm-hmm.
So if his ex was the intended target, you shouldn't be on the case.
Yeah, no, not at all.
Denise Huskins and Aaron Quinn stayed together and got married in Monterey, California in 2018. They now have two daughters, Olivia, who was born on March 25th, 2020, exactly 5 years to the day after Denise was released by her kidnapper.
Wow, what are the odds of that?
I know, right?
That's crazy.
I feel like Olivia was like, you need this day to be something better.
Positive, yeah.
Yeah. And Naomi, who was born in 2022.
Oh, that's precious.
Denise and Aaron also became friends with Misty Caruso. She is now a sergeant at the in the Alameda County Sheriff's Office.
Hell yeah, as she should be. She should be running that whole fucking place, okay?
She should. There have been a lot of questions that remained after this all came to an end in 2015. Were there others involved? Mueller mentioned there being others, and Denise is sure she saw someone else. Was it just the blow-up doll? We may never know, but it does seem like Denise is adamant that somebody else was involved.
Yeah.
Another question is, why were Aaron and or Andrea targets in the first place? There is a big conspiracy that Mueller brought up in court that I'm not going to go into because it doesn't honestly deserve the attention because it's all just him rambling on in a conspiracy.
Well, tell me.
I'll send you the article. I will link the article. There's a whole really awesome article in Atavist magazine that talks about a whole bunch of different aspects of the case, about Mueller, all kinds of stuff, and that is in there. So I will link that if you guys want to check it out.
I had a theory with that, especially after learning that he was a peeping Tom, that maybe he had been peeping on her and then got up the courage to take it the next step.
Definitely could be, yeah.
But in between that time frame, out with the old, in with the new, and oops.
Interesting.
Of mistaken identity.
Yeah, that so, definitely could be. Yeah.
I don't know. That was just my little theory that I came up with after I found out that, you know.
I could see that being the case, yeah.
Being a little nasty.
Yeah, that definitely could be. Also, a question is, why were police so convinced this was a hoax? Was it because of the movie Gone Girl? Was it just because they suspected her? Was there something else going on? And why have they never taken responsibility publicly?
Especially when they were so convinced that it was a murder investigation from the beginning. Right. So they didn't really, they were just flipping the script like on whatever they just felt like doing, which is not how you police. No. Investigate. Like, no.
But that is the case of the kidnapping of Denise Huskins. Usually we don't share our opinions, but I'm going to share my opinion here. If you can't already tell, I 1,000% believe Aaron and Denise. I mean, obviously somebody was arrested. I don't think that Aaron was involved. I really don't think Andrea was involved either. I actually really like your theory. I feel like that could be very, I don't know, that just feels right.
Especially because he was doing it right there in that. I don't know how big Mare Island is, but it sounds
it's not super big. Yeah.
I mean, you know, if he was a homebody and fixated on this person, you know, if he was having a mental crisis and
doing these things
that, I mean,
could be
been like, okay, I want to take this, I want to escalate this, I want to take this to the next level. And that takes obviously preparation, because he had to find out who she was, who he was, like who Aaron was. And, you know, he knew things about them. So,
So it definitely could be. I don't know. I like that theory. I am running with that, but I don't think that, like, there was any, because there are still people who suspect, like, one of them being involved and having, like, hired Mueller or something.
Well, that's what I even said that to you, Haley, that, you know, I was like, let's go off on a wild goose chase. Let's say, what if he was a hired, whatever, kidnapper, rapist? I mean, obviously people don't, like, you know, I don't know, maybe they do, but, like, hired to kidnap Andrea, or even hired by Andrea to kidnap Denise, so I mean, it crossed my mind, I will admit. It did, but then I was like, that is just too wild. It can't be true. It cannot be true.
I don't think so, and I don't think he would have not given that information up at this point. Like, if that was true, I think he would have given that up. So I don't really see that as being true, but like you said, it crossed my mind too. So
but
if you guys haven't watched the series, even though you know the whole story now, I'd still recommend watching it, because it's told from Aaron and Denise's point of view, and you get to see Misty and her badass thought process. There's also an ABC 2020 episode about it that you can watch, but that is the crazy true story of the kidnapping of Denise Huskins. I hope you guys liked this deep dive into this case.
You did a great job. You told me things I didn't know. I mean, I didn't like super deep dive after I watched the docuseries, but yeah, you told me some things.
But that's why I wanted to share it, because I was like, there is, you know, the docuseries did a great job covering it, but there was some stuff that wasn't covered. So thank you guys for listening. We will see you next time, and until then, keep it human.
Bye guys.